Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Boom Culture, the podcast where we talk about pop culture, but bigger. My name is Max, and I am joined today by...
Alex Baker.
Alex, what the fuck are we doing here?
Kind of the whole origin of this thing was what we've done in the past when you and I have gotten together, Max and Alex, amazing drunk adventures, is much to the pain and anguish of your wife and my girlfriend, we end up talking about movies for about a good 6 or 7 hours, and almost nobody else can join in with us. And then one day, you said, we should record this and put it on the internet, and we might find people who actually can talk about this with us. And I said, what a great idea.
That sounds about right. Now, do you think that we get into these long conversations about movies because we lack an inner life aside from the material that other people provide to us to analyze? Deafening silence. That's rough.
Yeah, that was a tough psychological question. I can't answer that.
So today we are covering Prometheus.
Prometheus.
Being the, I guess perhaps this is debatable. I was going to say this is the fifth film in the Alien series.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask Damon Lindelof, then yes, it's the fifth Alien movie. But if you ask Ridley Scott, then no, it's not the fifth Alien movie.
Well, let's jump right into this now. So, I mean, obviously Ridley Scott is someone whose opinion on that holds some water, that he's got a little bit of weight in the franchise. First director to return to the franchise, directed the first movie, Alien, scripted by Dan O'Bannon and some other guy who hasn't done much else, released in 1979. I think we all know that.
So it's like for them, it was like the To Kill a Mockingbird of their film writing days. They did it once, they did it great, and then never could do it again.
Yeah, except that people remember Harper Lee's name.
Good point.
So this is a franchise that is, well, I don't know, is it unique? It's highly unusual in that it is a franchise which, until Prometheus, had been helmed by a different director with each installment. Pretty big swings in tone between each of the installments. Second one, Aliens, directed by James Cameron, more of an action movie. Third one, David Fincher. We can talk a little bit about that. That one's, I don't know, it's dark, it's a drama, maybe a bit closer in tone to the first.
Yeah, brooding. But only if you watch the director's cut. If you watch the theatrical cut, it's almost like Resurrection. Fincher had big dreams for long hallway shots, and the production company did not want, so they kind of went at it with a meat axe to give it a more action feel before they released it in theaters.
You know, he sort of walked away at some point. It's unclear whether he was closely involved in the final edit or even present at the end of the shoot. But he's gone on to have a great career. The fourth installment in the franchise, Alien Resurrection.
do we talk about this? Do we just skip this one and go right to Alien vs. Predator? Because Alien Resurrection is disgusting. It was a horrible, horrible thing.
Okay, so I was going to ask, Jean-Pierre Jeunet, are you familiar with his other films?
Oh, yeah, and Delicatessen's a great thing. I think, to me, it feels like Alien Resurrection was given to him, maybe assigned to him, because I don't know why anybody would have taken that script, and even as a talented director, because I've seen his other films and I like them a lot, and it's obvious that he has talent, but it wasn't obvious in Alien Resurrection.
Yeah, I think that impression is correct. I mean, when you talk about the script and how it is kind of a shit script, that's surprising to me, because that's a script by Joss Whedon, who I think he's best known for good scripting and good dialogue in particular, and that movie just doesn't have it.
This just makes me think that nobody's perfect, because after this, like you said, Joss Whedon had a skyrocketingly successful career, and every single thing he puts his hands in seems to turn into gold. Then we keep talking about this, like great directors who are involved in the Alien franchise. David Fincher, who's gone on to be one of the most well-known and respected directors of our time, started making kind of a crummy Alien movie. Joss Whedon, one of the best like dork lore guys that we have out there right now, started writing a crummy script for a crummy movie.
Alien Resurrection, anyway, not a success as a film, and obviously the franchise sort of went to shit from there. I don't have anything to say about Alien versus Predator except for the fact that I fell asleep in the theater watching it.
I didn't even see it because it was rated PG-13, and I thought, how the fuck can anybody have a movie with our aliens and our predators so well known in like the cultural and like a dorky vernacular to be just bloodthirsty, perfect killing machines, and then to throw them together into a movie and rated PG-13. I was just thinking, why on earth would this happen other than to get teenagers into the audience to pay ticket prices?
I don't think there was any other reason. Would you consider yourself a fan of the Alien franchise and of?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Every time people talk about favorite horror movies, one of the first movies that pops into my head is Alien, and I always think that's kind of bizarre. But then you think about it, and it's probably the perfect haunted house story. What Ridley Scott did to make a kind of a horror movie that everybody knows the formula for, the haunted house. You find a haunted house, you go in, things seem a little bizarre, but kind of laughable until the shit hits the fan and actually starts happening to you with a single unknown entity. And it's kind of terrifying. I saw it in theaters for the 25th anniversary. My father took me, and I just remember being just so scared shitless watching this movie in theaters, even though I had seen it probably 30 times before that. And Aliens, like, there's not an action movie that's better than Aliens, especially when you consider that every single line uttered in that movie is utterly and totally quotable. And everybody knows Aliens, even more so, I think, than Alien. So I know so many people who have seen Aliens without actually having seen Alien. And I really like David Fincher's director's cut of the third one. And I loved Prometheus, too. So, like, if you take off the sophomore years of this franchise, then yes, I really do consider myself a fan of the Alien franchise. In general, most of the Alien movies we have in like film libraries are giving us one of two things to think about. One, that yes, aliens can be our friends, like we can talk to them, we can communicate with them, or we can talk to them and we can communicate them, but they still want to kill us. I think Ridley Scott was the very first person to ever give us like an alien being that was a single-minded, instinctual entity, which was what was so terrifying about it, because you can't flash lights at this thing, like you can't take him to the president to discuss like politics. You just have to kill or be killed.
Yeah, he's no take me to your leader type of thing. And you know, a lot of that credit goes to Scott as an atmospheric director, something that I think he excels at. Ridley Scott builds a world, and in this case, an incredibly haunting world, and a pace of a movie that it's just a slow build. It's a very patient movie. I think it's about a half an hour before they get to the.
To the eggs.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any, it's a classic, obviously. Nobody needs to be told how great Alien is, but we're going to do that anyway.
It's great.
A lot of the credit goes also to H.R. Giger, who came up with the alien design as adapted into the film. I think we're both fans of this director, of this series. Although I would note that with Scott, you know, I haven't really liked anything he's done since Gladiator in 2000. He had an unbelievable out of the gate with Blade Runner and Alien. I think if you look at a lot of modern sci-fi, you can trace it back pretty directly, especially aesthetically, to Blade Runner. And we can talk a little bit. That's a movie that's based on the work of an author who you and I are both big fans of, I think, Philip K. Dick. And I think there's a bit to talk about in this movie with regard to Philip K. Dick, and in particular, the question of what it is to be human. What is it to be a human? What is it to be a simulacrum of a human?
I just always think of those people like the way that the way Ripley always freaks out every time she talks about him. And what is it Bishop says? He's like, I prefer
artificial human. Is that what he's
artificial saying? Human. Yeah. She calls him a synthetic. And he's like, well, I prefer artificial human. Like the very first sense of Bishop's undyingly dry wit.
Sigourney Weaver's character Ripley has a bad experience with an android who she doesn't know is an android in the first movie, played by Ian Holm. Cameron smartly flips that in the second movie with the character Bishop, who's actually an ally, also a artificial human.
Completely off topic, speaking of Cameron doing that genius flip, he does the same shit in Terminator 2 when he has a small lifelike man show up and then the big Arnold Terminator. And so everybody in the audience thinks we're having the same experience as the first one. But just kidding, it's the small Ryan-like figure that we're supposed to be afraid of and the Arnold Schwarzenegger that we're not, which I think that he did the kind of the same thing in Alien, where he gave us a synthetic and it ended up turned him into the hero rather than the villain.
That's a great point. Anyway, let's move on to Prometheus.
Okay, let's do it.
Should we give a plot summary before we...
Okay, what we've got is, in the very beginning, we got a big, white, buff motherfucker who's standing on the edge of a waterfall. In the background, he's got his ship taken off behind him. He opens up a little... makeup case of black goo, takes a hit of it, dissolves, falls into the water. We see the splitting of cells, the birth of DNA, arguably the creation of our species. 2 million years later, I can't remember what it was. We have Dr. Shaw, Elizabeth Shaw, and Charlie Holloway. We got them as archaeologists. They're finding the third and final piece to a puzzle they seem to have been putting together for a while of ancient civilization drawings on the walls of a star man pointing to what appears to be a star map, and they have found this drawing in four different young society, like civilizations drawings that have no way to be connected to one another via oceans and land masses. They probably didn't even know the other civilizations existed, not to mention the years in between them. So Shaw believes this is an invitation for them to come and find the creators of men. We have her as a Christ believer, a Christian, and Charlie Holloway as a diehard scientist.
You know, I'm not familiar with that phrase, Christ believer. I haven't run across Christ that
believer.
One. Oh, yeah. Is that okay?
That's someone who believes in Christ. But I think, as I'll talk about later, Ridley Scott did suggest something about Christ in the way of the engineers. So yeah, so we got them. They want to find this planet where the engineers are from, and so we have the Wayland Corporation, assuming the same Wayland Industries as the ship that Ripley is on in Alien, the mining company, funding a trip to LV-223 with Idris Elba as the captain of the Prometheus, a scientific vessel. We have Charlize Theron as Meredith Vickers, as kind of the face of Wayland.
She's the corporate representative, as we understand it at the beginning.
Yeah, and they go into cryosleep, which if you're familiar with the Alien universe, you're familiar with the prospect of cryosleep. And we have probably the one thing we might talk about most here. We have David taking care of all of our crew members in their four-year cryosleep to get to this moon.
David, a character that was one of the primary focuses of the kind of interesting viral marketing campaign for this movie. This movie was released in 2012, well into the era where Hollywood studios are trying anything they can to sell movies. And I think in this case, they were trying also to get some stuff out there that would not remind people of the Alien versus Predator franchise, trying to cleanse the palate, as it were. So anyway, yeah, David, I agree. That's a character we're going to spend some time on here.
What is it about robots that makes them so robotic? At Wayland Industries, it has long been our goal to create artificial intelligence almost indistinguishable from mankind itself. Hello, I'm David.
What can you do, David?
I can do almost anything that could possibly be asked of me. I can assist your employees. I can make your organization more efficient. I can carry out directives that my human counterparts might find distressing or unethical. I can blend in with your workforce effortlessly.
David, what do you think about?
I think about anything. Children playing. Angels. The universe. Robots.
David, what makes you sad?
War. Poverty. Cruelty. Unnecessary violence. I understand human emotions, although I do not feel them myself. This allows me to be more efficient and capable, and makes it easier for my human counterparts to interact with me.
Is there anything you would like to say, David?
I would like to express gratitude to those who created me. Happy birthday, David. From Wayland Industries. Eighth generation Wayland type. Technological, intellectual, physical, emotional.
Yeah, so is it Fassbender? Michael Fassbender is playing David.
It's actually just Michael Fassbender. It's not like Ford Maddox Ford.
Okay. Sorry. You know, common mistake. We have David here taking care of all of our passengers in their cryo sleep, and he's watching Shaw dream. He's watching Lawrence of Arabia. He is being inspired to dye and cut his hair like Lawrence of Arabia. He's learning every language that he can, and riding a bicycle on the ship.
What he's doing, he's riding a bicycle around in circles and with one hand sinking basketball shot after basketball shot in what I can only assume is a callback to Sigourney Weaver throwing the ball, you know, backwards and sinking it in Alien Resurrection.
Right.
Did you actually think that he might be a human?
Well, that's what I'm saying. If you were unfamiliar with the Alien franchise, you might have assumed him. But if you knew anything about the synthetics of Bilbo from the first one or Bishop from the second one, then you would know that synthetics and the way that they are and the way that they act and talk and speak, then you would almost immediately know what David was upon seeing him. He's taking care of them. They wake up when they reach the moon 4 years after their departure. And then it gets weird. They find the engineers in what appears to be a satellite military base, housing what could be the most toxic and lethal biological weapon ever created. And then shit hits the fan. Then the action starts and the movie goes on.
Starting from the very beginning here, it's been a while since we saw this. Little inside baseball here. We've been meaning to record this for a while. I don't know if you went back and brushed up your Shakespeare. You did a little bit. So did the opening Fox logo was tinted blue, correct? Did you notice this?
Yeah, the whole movie kind of has that.
Yeah, I know. I noticed that just because Alien 3 also had a special version of the Fox logo. So I thought that was a cute callback, just this franchise. It's got a history of playing with that stock opening and giving you a hint of what the film's going to be like.
Yeah, I'm watching the opening right now, and it is very blue, very blue. You almost can't even tell the 20th Century Fox thing is supposed to be gold because of how filtered this intro is. You're talking about how one of the things that Ridley Scott does best is atmospheric, and I think to start off the official conversation of Prometheus, we should start with the official beginning of Prometheus, which is the long helicopter shots of what we could easily refer to as Eden.
That beginning that you mentioned with those helicopter shots of a landscape that, you know, I take to be prehistoric Earth, and I think you do too, although Scott has said that it doesn't really matter what planet it is, maybe it's Earth, maybe it's not. You know, all that suggests to me is that this is something that this race, the engineers, what we're going to call them, these albino bodybuilders, have done this not just here but elsewhere, that they seed life. We don't know why, at least not yet in this opening, but...
Oh, so you think that we are not the only creation, that they have in fact been doing this for a while?
There's nothing in the movie that says that clearly to me, but authorial intent, right? What did Scott intend? At what point did he intend it? How did things evolve during filming? I think that what you get out of a movie as a viewer, what you get out of a book as a reader is more important. I don't think that there's necessarily a objective correct answer and that the author is the arbiter of what their own work means. But in this case, the fact that he says this could be Earth, it could not be, says to me that this is something they've done not just on Earth, but elsewhere. I don't get that from the movie itself, but what he says doesn't seem to contradict anything in the movie. But yeah, I take it as prehistoric Earth. And boy, that stuff's gorgeous. You're right. Profoundly talented visual director.
I think that's why I say Eden. A lot of the interpretations I took out of this were biblical. And just to give a place, be it Earth, be it not Earth, that is just like so jaw-droppingly beautiful, so pristine. Like there's no buildings, there's no cars, there's obviously nothing here but Earth, except to when we get to the engineer. And then we have the engineer giving this place the one thing essentially that they think it needs, which is life.
What do you think about the engineer? What's your first impression?
One, it's a great makeup. I think that was V. Davis, I think her name is. She's really famous for X-Files, and she's won a couple of Oscars, so I'm not surprised that they brought her in for this. It's kind of an unbelievable thing. It's kind of hard to think about what you're looking at while it's moving and seeing, like, the muscles ripple and seeing its mouth work.
And is this a puppet, or is this a guy in makeup? I have no idea.
It's a guy in makeup. I've seen videos of them putting him in. It's kind of got, like, a stilted shoulder to put the head up farther. Other than that, it's vinyl and a little bit of latex and a lot of paint.
That's really remarkable. It's a great makeup job. You know, I assume that it was CGI just because it didn't look like latex. His face is moving, and there may be some CG touch-up on it, too. But I agree. It's a very good makeup job. What do you think about the design? I mean, they look like humans, but bigger, right?
Bigger, and they're perfect. You know, like, if we think about what the gods are supposed to look like, or, like, what Zeus looks like and what Thor looks like, depending on your take of the gods. I look at the engineer. He's kind of awe-inspiring in his... I have to find a word. He's beautiful in his own way, but terrifying at the same time. He walks up in the robe, he takes it off, and he's pale and muscular. And he, I think they're supposed to be, what, 8 feet?
Yeah, they're taller than people. I don't know exactly, but you know, the bone structure in the face is interesting. I like the fact that they have these oddly aquiline noses, almost like more Roman than Roman noses.
Yes.
But, I have to say, I was a little disappointed by this conception. You know, I understand why they look like us, given that what happens is that this guy drinks some black goo that seems to dissolve him. And then we get one of these just completely inescapable title sequences of DNA strands that we've been getting since, I don't know, the first Spider-Man movie or X-Men or whatever. But I've seen this too many times now. I was rolling my eyes at it.
Scott does do us a favor. Like, I just watched it, and the DNA, like the DNA and the cell splitting is only about 15 seconds. And it's not like the 3 minutes you have to sit through in any given superhero movie.
And it looks cool. I mean, you get these little globules of the black goo sort of corrupting the DNA. There's
absolutely,
it's definitely a visual cue there. But for a series that is known for the alienness in the most essential sense of its antagonist, the fact that these guys look like Star Trek aliens, you know, the forehead's a little different, is disappointing to me on some level. Noomi Rapace, the actress who plays Elizabeth Shaw in this movie, who's got a very interesting look. She's Icelandic. You know, her bone structure looks exactly as alien as these guys do, you know?
Exactly. Noomi Rapace. And it's actually fun to see her in this film, because the last time we saw her, if you ignored Sherlock Holmes, the Game of Shadows, she was the girl with the dragon tattoo. She was Lisbeth. And so that was kind of an alarming way to see her for three films. So it was nice to see her as she was in Prometheus.
This is my first experience of her on screen, although I had heard of her beforehand. So this scene, the engineer eats some caviar, some fissures open up in him. His foot falls off. He starts spraying black blood out the back of his head. He's moaning like the Black Knight in Monty Python. But he's doing this on purpose, right?
Oh, yes. This is a sacrifice.
This is a sacrifice. He is intending to seed life here, yeah?
Yes. This is the creation. No, he absolutely knows what he's getting himself into. It was a choice. And who knows? It might even be an honor. He could be the one that they modeled the head after, or be one of the statues in the great goo-carrying hall. It's obviously an important task. He comes in nothing but the robe that he sheds. And later, when we see the engineers, we see them in suits of armor, such like futuristic armor, essentially. So
one of the things that we haven't said yet is that the engineers are a race that does appear in the original Alien movie, although in unrecognizable form, because I think we've always assumed that that suit of armor is what they look like. The space jockey is the sort of term that I think has gained currency to describe them in that initial scene. So it's the giant thing that we see with its chest burst in the original Alien. That's before anything bad happens to the humans, it's the little cue that this is going to happen to you.
Right, the elephantine mask, the fossilized body armor. So that's why I feel that this was a sacrifice. Because he's not wearing the space jockey suit.
Is he in a robe and diaper? Is that what I remember?
Essentially, he comes up like Obi-Wan scaring the sand people away, and then he drops that, and all he's got is the diaper on, yeah.
And then we get that DNA sequence that we talked about. And then we cut to Charlie and Elizabeth, who are clearly she is our protagonist. She is, I think we can, if you haven't figured it out yet, we're not concerned about spoiling things. She's the one who survives this movie, in addition to one other character. Charlie does not, but they're a couple. They're staring at a cave painting. And then they exposit, they posit that it's gone to predate the others by millennia. And then we get the shot of the Prometheus, the scientific exploratory vessel Prometheus, and the scene card that tells us a bit about it. It tells us when this movie is set. It's set in 2093, just before and through Christmas. 17 people on the vessel. And it tells us that it is 3.27 times 10 to the 14th kilometers from Earth. That's about 3.5 light years. Can I drop a little bit of...
Please, beware, science ahead.
Pluto is between 4 and 7 light hours from Earth, depending on where the planets are in orbit, right? Alpha Centauri is 4.4 light years from Earth. That's the closest star to our sun. Vulcan from Star Trek is 16 light years from Earth. Prometheus, to put it in Star Wars terms, is just over a parsec from Earth. A parsec is about 3.26 yes. light years. The point is that this planet is closer than Alpha Centauri. It's extremely close to Earth. Do they talk about, the distance that they are, right? They say that they've been traveling for, what, did you say 4 years?
I believe they're in crisis for 4 years. Yeah.
In crisis.
In crisis. Foreshadowing.
Nobody is dead yet, as Vickers, that's her first question out of the box. Is anybody dead?
Has anyone died?
What's the word I'm thinking of then?
Cryostasis.
Cryostasis. I just shortened it, you know, crisis.
What is this planet orbiting? There's light on this planet, and yet it is not in our solar system.
They say that it's a moon, and it's orbiting a bigger planet that... don't they say that it has its own sun? I don't know if like if they were considering that people like you would actually break down the distance and be like, excuse me, there are no suns that close. I think when it comes to the initial distance and the bad science of it, we have to have a little bit of like willing suspension of disbelief.
You're right. And that didn't bother me when I was watching the movie.
We could have a whole other conversation about how the people you're reading are doing their research and George Lucas is not, because we have Han Solo making a Kessel run in under 12 parsecs, which, assuming you're thinking like a normal person, means that he did it in a span of time that's supposed to be impressive, but not a span of distance.
Woof. I don't even like Star Wars that much, and I've thought about that shit in the past.
Okay.
We move from this title card to, like you said, something that is a staple of the series, which is cryosleep. We jump to Elizabeth in stasis. I don't think we know at this point that it's the same woman we just saw, though it's not a huge surprise. And then here comes Michael Fassbender, who is one of my favorite young actors. This guy, he played Magneto in X-Men yeah. First Class. He was great in that. And here, too, he is a sympathetic character, but a character with his own agenda. So I was a little confused the first watching. I actually had to go back and go through this a couple more times to figure out what's going on. I think what's happening is that he's watching Elizabeth's dreams.
Dream, yeah. He's got it set up. And I feel like she's the only one whose dreams he's watching.
I think that's right. And it's not entirely clear why that is, but he does communicate with Peter Weyland, who was on the ship as well, in stasis later in the film, and he's wearing this. He puts on this like Daft Punk helmet to do this.
Yeah,
and he wears absolutely. The same helmet then, so it's some sort of technology that allows him to communicate with people who are semi-conscious. And I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, I don't love the execution of it. Like, I don't like the fact that he's sort of seeing a 3D imagery of Elizabeth Shaw's memories, and it's using this concentric ring effect that we use for an alien technology hologram later in the movie. I guess her memories are digital, or like, it's like he's watching video playing over like shitty wireframes. I thought that effect bugged the hell out of me when I thought about what it was and what it meant. But I don't mind the fact that he's interacting on some sort of semi-conscious level with people in stasis.
I thought that would have been much, much better if he was doing it just for fun. But Scott is using Shaw's dream as a kind of a vessel to explain a little bit about her to us. Like, we see her living with her father in some country, and they're talking about what death means in different cultures. And he gives her the cross. So now we know that Shaw is a Christ believer, if you will, and it's more exposition through dialogue than it is like a really interesting thing that David's doing. If it had just been some random crazy dream that she was having and he was trying to unlock a little bit of it from her, then that would have been like a little bit more for him other than for us. But since Scott used it as a vessel to explain some things without actually having to explain them, I was kind of turned off by the whole dream watching thing.
It did feel a little bit like he wrote some facts on the end of a baseball bat and then hit us in the head with them.
Absolutely, yeah.
Her mom is dead. Her dad's a missionary. They're in Africa.
Why aren't you helping them?
They don't want my help. Their god is different than ours.
Where do they go?
Everyone has their own word. Heaven. Paradise. Whatever it's called. Someplace beautiful.
How do you know it's beautiful?
Because that's what I choose to believe.
I just wanted to draw one more connection to the sort of the history of the franchise. So Dan O'Bannon, who co-wrote the first Alien movie, had previously written a movie called Dark Star, which was directed by John Carpenter, and which had some connections to the Alien franchise in that there's a sequence there with like an alien creature that's not actually frightening looking, but that's chasing people around a spaceship, and it's sort of where he first started playing with the ideas that, you know, later made up the entirety of Alien. And there's also a bit in that movie where, and also connected to Philip K. Dick, who did a similar thing in the novel called Ubik, the captain of the spaceship in Dark Star is dead or in some sort of half-life, and people are communicating with him while he's in that state. And that's something that I felt like he was consciously or not calling back to here. So going back to Michael Fassbender, going back to David, the character of David the Android, bicycle riding, basketball playing, learning ancient languages immediately, maintaining excellent posture. He is awake and watching Lawrence of Arabia. As you said, everybody else is in stasis. I've actually never seen Lawrence of Arabia, so maybe we need to do that one at some point. Have you?
Yes, I've seen it a couple times. It's about 4 hours long. There's not a single woman in it. It's kind of like a gay love story. And I mean, it's great, but it's long.
I really enjoy the ambiguous foreshadowing of the part that we're shown here, which is him burning his fingers and then telling someone that the trick is not minding that it hurts. And then we get a little thing that I think is a much better piece of characterization of David than, as you said, the fact that he's eavesdropping on Elizabeth Shaw's mind, which is that he bleaches his hair. I think that's really, yeah, that's really telling. That's an incredibly aspirational thing to do. It's very human.
Yeah, it's a bold choice, especially because he does the look of Lawrence of Arabia, Peter O'Toole, in that movie. But also, it kind of begs the question to me if that is the end-all be-all, because if a synthetic is incapable of growing back hair, then he's going to have bleached hair until he decides to color it again, but he also kind of cuts it and like styles it. So
I guess I assumed that either he could buy a new scalp or that it does grow. Yeah, it's not clear.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that there's two characters who are annoyed in different ways by his inhumanness later on in the movie, and neither of them throws it at him that he dyed his hair, right? Neither of them puts that in his face and says, "You wish you were human, you're not human." Anyway, it's a small moment and it's quietly done. It's subtle in a way that, as we said, a lot of the dialogue thus far has not been. And then people start to wake up, right?
Yeah, we have that beautiful scene before the alarms start going off when David feels a shift in the Prometheus and he's standing next to that pool table. He's looking around and the balls in their holder are sliding across and the pool cue is rolling across the table as if like a giant Prometheus break was hit. And he kind of is looking around almost as if he doesn't know what's happening before the alarms start going off and he remembers what exactly he was doing on Prometheus in the first place and that his job was to remind everybody when they get there. So it's almost like, what was that? What am I doing here? And then the alarms go off and he's like, oh, yes.
That's interesting. I didn't notice that moment. That's a nice little moment too. And then we get a little morning sickness from Elizabeth Shaw. She wakes up, and this is a callback to previous ones in the series as well. People vomit when they come out of cryosleep. It seems pretty unpleasant. I also wondered if that was a little joke from Ridley Scott or from the screenwriters, given the themes of this movie and the series as a whole. You know, Alien has always been about pregnancy in different ways. The first one was about male pregnancy as horror. The second one and the third one were in different ways about Ripley as a mother.
And that's the important thing about Newt in Aliens, is that she becomes kind of the adopted mother.
And we get, with the rest of the crew waking up, really broad characterizations. Would you agree?
This is something I actually read about Lindelof. And the reason he has such wild characters and in such a broad span is because he loved that so much about Aliens. When everybody wakes up, you had the Marines, you had the scientists, you had Ripley, you had like the skeezy lawyer, you had the Bill Paxton character, then you had, what was her name? The little butchy Mexican one. That's what David Lindelof was talking about. One of the reasons he loved Aliens was so much was that initial scene where we get all the characters at once. Everybody's waking up. up at exactly the same time, and he wanted to have a thing like that in Prometheus, because he was talking about how you get to know these characters immediately, and knowing the kind of film it is, it's fun to start guessing who's going to die first, who's going to live throughout this whole thing. He wanted to be able to give that gift to people when he was doing some of the major rewrites.
And you know who they are immediately because they are stereotypes or archetypes, depending on how you want to look at it.
Oh, they're caricatures. It's so silly.
Hey, Mira, who's Snow White?
She's supposed to be some kind of consultant. Apparently, she saw an alien one.
Whoopie fucking do. Hey, I'm impressed.
You believe that?
Hey, Vasquez, have you ever been mistaken for a man?
No. Have you?
Oh, Vasquez. Ow. It is too bad.
I don't remember exactly what the progression is, but at some point we see Guy Pearce here. Yeah, this is before it is revealed that he is in fact on the ship. We get a hologram of him.
I have already died. May I rest in peace.
And my God, the makeup on Guy Pearce.
it's unbelievable. I didn't know it was him until I left the theater and someone told me.
It doesn't even look like latex makeup. It looks like they put like latex paint on him and let it dry. I just thought this makeup was god awful.
Well, I think it kind of comes into the point of why he's even wanting to do this, which we can talk about later, like Waylon's purpose here. But I think the style of the makeup and the look they gave him, to me, is kind of a clear indicator of what he's been doing to himself and what he has been making the Waylon Corporation all about this whole time.
You read the fact that he looks like time has taken such an awful toll on his face as indicative of the fact that he's been doing things to extend his life?
Yeah, the whole point of him coming to the moon was to find the engineers to give him the gift of life and to end his death clock, if you will. And so I feel like he's probably been doing that enough with his own money to try and figure it out and can't do it, which is the only reason why he gave so much money to the Prometheus expedition anyways. The whole corporation is layered with his own selfishness. I don't think he gives a shit about what they do.
I think he's 103 in this movie.
Okay, which is old, probably even for 2093.
Is it? Because my God, technology has advanced like a ridiculous amount in 81 years. This movie was released in 2012, set in 2093. We have completely convincing artificial intelligence driven androids. We have spaceships. We have, what else? Holograms. Cryostasis.
All that's true. But I'm saying the human body, there's nothing I don't think technology could ever do to keep it from getting old. Like, it's just biology. And no matter how great of a technology we have, 103 to me is still old. Just purely based on like biological deterioration.
Like you said, Waylon calls David the closest thing he has to a son. And he talks about the fact that David will not grow old and die and refers to these as gifts. So he is, as you say, seeking immortality from the start. And I think that another one of the viral materials they released before this movie, which was a fake TED talk from Peter Waylon set in 2020 something, was also about that.
T.E. Lawrence, eponymously of Arabia, but very much an Englishman, favored pinching a burning match between his fingers to put it out. When asked by his colleague, William Potter, to reveal his trick, how is it he so effectively extinguished the flame without hurting himself whatsoever, Lawrence just smiled and said, "The trick, Potter, is not minding it hurts." The fire that danced at the end of that match was a gift from the Titan Prometheus, a gift that he stole from the gods when Prometheus was caught and brought to justice for his theft. The gods, well, you might say they overreacted a little. The poor man was tied to a rock as an eagle ripped through his belly and ate his liver over and over. Day after day, ad infinitum. All because he gave us fire, our first true piece of technology. Fire. 100,000 BC, stone tools. 4,000 BC, the wheel. 9th century AD, gunpowder. Bit of a game changer, that one. 19th century, Eureka, the light bulb. 20th century, the automobile, television, nuclear weapons, spacecraft, internet. 21st century. Biotech, nanotech, fusion and fission and M-theory. And that was just the first decade. We are now 3 months into the year of our Lord, 2023. At this moment in our civilization, we can create cybernetic individuals who, in just a few short years, will be completely indistinguishable from us. Which leads to an obvious conclusion. We are the gods now. For those of you who know me, you will be aware by now that my ambition is unlimited. You know that I will settle for nothing short of greatness, or I will die trying. For those of you who do not yet know me, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Peter Weyland. And if you'll indulge me, I'd like to change the world.
David doesn't look very happy when Weyland says that David is without a soul.
Yeah.
That is sort of the arc for David, right?
Yeah, I think that the pure scene of him reacting to that says so much more of him actually having one than not having one. And the way he acts later in the film, I feel like there has to be something other than programming in David.
Oh, I completely agree. Some of the best themes in this movie are the paralleling, the twinning of our creation of David and what we think about him and the engineer's creation of us. And we don't know what they think about us, but that's one of the most interesting things in this movie. Weyland asks a few questions here. He asks, where do we come from? What is our purpose? What happens when we die? He delivers these rhetorically, but I think he's intending these as the questions that this expedition will answer. Do we get answers to any of those? One of them, right? We know where we come from at the end of this movie.
Yeah, and then what happens when we die? That, for Shaw, is the reason she keeps going. The reason she picks up David's head, gets on the engineer ship, and leaves. Her whole point in this movie is that, even when her and Charlie are arguing, he's like, why do you still wear that cross? And she's like, oh, well, you know, I still believe in God. And he's like, how can you believe in God? Like, we just found how we were made. And she's like, well, that's not the end-all be-all for me. Regardless of knowing how she was made, I think she is more concerned with finding out where we end up.
Another nice parallel there, a little mirroring. She still believes at the end, as opposed to Weyland, who, when Weyland dies later in this movie, he says, there's nothing, is there? And David says, I know. Is Weyland intentionally sowing confusion about who is in charge of this mission when he says that the scientists are in charge? But at the same time, we have this corporate officer, Vickers, who seems to be in charge in some capacity in that they put up the money for it. And then, of course, we have a captain of the ship, which is Idris Elba as Captain Yannick.
The captain of the ship is, I think, just that, the captain of the ship. He can be contracted to do this, and he will be in charge of the ship, but not necessarily of what goes on outside of it. When he says the scientists are in charge, I think he means it, because Vickers, the head of the corporation, won't have the ability to find what they came there to find or to say what they came there to say. And I think she kind of takes that in offense. And she, you could almost argue, is the reason why the plot fails, because Vickers takes it upon herself to be in charge and starts making a series of rash decisions.
That's not how I read her actions. I actually read her as, for example, when there's a contaminated crew member later on, she doesn't want to let him on the ship. Other people do. At this point, Holloway and Shaw start giving a briefing to the rest of the crew explaining what they're doing there.
These are ancient civilizations that were separated by centuries. They shared no contact with one another, and yet the same pictogram showing men worshipping giant beings pointing to the stars was discovered at every last one of them.
So you're saying we're here because of a map you two kids found in a cave, is that right?
They're making so many assumptions about what it is that these cave paintings mean. They think of them as an invitation. They are the ones who come up with the name engineers because, quote, they engineered us. They assume, based on no knowledge, they haven't seen the prologue of this movie. We have. She knows these things because of her faith. I have a really, really hard time identifying with this character, and I have a really hard time liking her because her personal beliefs seem to be completely at odds with what she's supposed to be doing as a competent person on this mission.
Yes, it is a kind of a strange reason to give someone like $1 trillion for an expedition into space. Just like Vickers, every choice she makes is for pride. I think every choice that Shaw makes is because of her faith, and it ends up leading her into all the wrong places. This is exactly what you said. She came on this mission that should be a scientific mission to find the creators of mankind, to find out what they mean for science, but she doesn't care about that almost. She only cares about what this means for faith. She's almost using science to prove the existence of God.
Hello, Mr. Wayland.
Hello.
I'm Dr. Elizabeth Shaw. If that name sounds familiar to you, it's because I've been calling your office every day for the last month. I think your people were hoping I'd give up. I'm not good at giving up. I'm an archaeologist. I have doctorates in paleontology, archaeology, human ethology, and memetics. This is not who I am. It's simply what I know. I make the distinction, sir, because there's a difference in what a scientist knows and what they believe. That difference is proof. Do you feel that all the science in the world will never give us the answers we really want? Where we came from? Whether or not we're truly alone? I believe there's a place where every one of those questions could be answered. I believe I know where that place is. I need you to get me there. If you don't respond, sir, I completely understand, but I'll be sending this transmission again tomorrow. Thank you.
So at this point, Vickers pulls the doctors aside. She wants a word about who's in charge, essentially. Vickers lives on a lifeboat, right? She lives on this part of the ship that can be separated to survive on its own. She says she likes to minimize risk. I like her. I completely identify with this character so far, except for the fact that she drinks straight vodka, which I don't. Shaw walks over to, there's this med pod device, this sort of auto surgery unit.
Yeah.
That's in Vickers' living area, and says that they only made a dozen of these. And I had a ton of issues with this scene. If this thing is so incredible, why did they only make a dozen of them? That is not how capitalism works. You don't put R&D dollars into making something good and then at that point realize that there's no market for it and only build 12 of them.
I don't think it's because there wasn't a market for it. If you build a machine that can heal all of your ailments and do everything that doctors do, then you have healthcare disappearing. You have people who aren't taking pills anymore. You just have money disappearing. So you have to take into consideration that, one, this machine might be fucking ridiculously expensive. And two, if you built enough of them for every person in America, you wouldn't have need of doctors anymore.
Elizabeth Shaw walks over to the med pod and starts behaving unbelievably inappropriately, right? She sees this insanely rare, expensive, sophisticated, probably delicate piece of machinery, and she starts manhandling it without asking permission. This is an archaeologist, remember. Vickers, well within her rights, is like, please don't touch that. And then Shaw takes this accusatory tone with Vickers. She says, it does bypass surgery? What do you need it for? It's rude. That's kind of a personal question.
True.
It also does way more than bypass surgery, so I'm not sure whether this is like an accent or language familiarity issue or just a script problem. Like, why focus on that as the thing that it does? And then Vickers sets them straight. She's like, look, I don't believe in your mission. You're not in charge. Holloway says he thinks he wrote a grant and was funded, but he is actually wrong about that. The Wayland Corporation owns that intellectual property now. And they are on board, Vickers tells them, because Peter Wayland was a superstitious man and he wanted true believers on board. So I like this scene. Like I said, I like Vickers. I think she's got her head screwed on straight. She does not think they're going to find shit. If I hadn't seen the previous movies in this series, I wouldn't think they were going to find shit either.
To be fair, that's an incredibly accurate point, you know, especially you saying honestly that her whole mission is based on faith, and somehow she must have talked Charlie into believing that these millennia old cave paintings could mean that there is a species still alive in space somewhere. I can't imagine an easier way to write that into a grant, you know.
You know what, I wish they had released that as viral material. I would read that grant and I would laugh. You mentioned, I think they gave a dollar figure for how much this ship or this expedition cost. Do you remember what it was? Like trillions of dollars, right?
Yeah, it was grotesque, is what it was. Shocking.
For somebody who wants to pursue immortality, you got to assume he must have exhausted every possible thing on Earth and had no interest in making anyone else's lives better, because That's a lot of money to spend to make yourself live forever. Anyway, David has been learning ancient languages. The thinking there is apparently that the language of the engineers may have something to do with ancient human languages, I guess.
I believe that's the purpose as well, because we find out later that David actually can speak engineer.
Speak to him, David. Tell him we came, just like he asked.
Itai, Guttum.
Although there are no subtitles in that scene later on, and it would be really funny if he was saying something incredibly offensive by accident.
And that's the only reason the engineer flips out the way he does.
Yeah, immediately after he speaks, the engineer does in fact rip his head off and then attempt to kill everyone else present. So.
Yeah. Oh, there's got to be something like that on YouTube. I'm going to have to find it.
And at this point, we get Captain Yannick, played by Idris Elba, taking the ship down to the moon. Have you seen Idris Elba in other things?
I've seen him in Pacific Rim, and I've seen him as Charles Minor in The Office.
Oh, his greatest role.
Absolutely. The Emmys really slighted him as the cruel usurper of the regional manager position of Michael Scott. I think it was a modern retelling of it was like a knight's errant.
I don't know. I thought I'd say it's more King Lear, Cape Fear, but definitely some really mythical stuff going on there. Idris Elba, best known in The Wire.
Which, if you'll hear Max talk about it, is the single greatest show that television had ever been graced with, almost solely based on a perfect written script.
Oh, the performances are great, too. Anyway, Stringer Bell in The Wire, his character, practically a Tony Soprano turn in that show, in spite of the fact that that was an ensemble show. And, you know, he doesn't squander any of that goodwill here, Idris Elba. He's fun.
Oh, absolutely. And he has an accordion that was Stephen Stills. What little we do see of him, we learn quite a bit about him. And he's also the first one to break the Ice Queen, that is Vickers.
Do you remember what he does in order to sleep with Charlize Theron's character here?
I can't remember.
He asks her if she's a robot. She's ignoring him. He's trying to be cute. He's playing the accordion. He's like, look, are you a robot or what? Because who wouldn't sleep with Idris Elba, obviously.
And excellent point.
She gets mad and wants to prove that she's not.
That you think that, but do you remember what happens after they sleep together?
No.
While they're sleeping together, the Scottish Mohawk and Dorky Big Hood are stuck in the caves. And that's when they meet our snake. And that's when they start calling for help to come have someone take them back. But nobody hears the distress calls in the captain's quarters because he's off breaking the ice.
Right, so they got stuck there due to a storm. He's monitoring the transmissions.
And he was following and like helping them avoid whatever life forms were moving down there.
I guess, or he was fucking with them also a little bit. He didn't seem too concerned about them, really.
Sleep tight. Try not to bugger each other.
Like, of course, he's having a little bit of fun because he didn't think there was anything down there. But once the second he leaves is when we have our first little tooth snake show up. And that's when we have Scottish Mohawk fall face first into the black goo, I guess being our second infestation of the black goo, but also the most dangerous one, and which could have been avoided had the captain's quarters been occupied and had he been doing his job. So I think...
You think she wanted this to happen, huh?
Yeah, that's my view. That she went in there, played hard to get, just so he would have a little bit of effort getting her, because I think she had a similar motive to David's, that they're like, once things actually started to happen, that she wanted to see what could happen before she took Wayland out of stasis.
So you're getting a real Paul Reiser read on her, parallel to the character in Aliens, played by Paul Reiser.
Yeah, but he's much wormier than her, obviously, much more sleazy. She is cold, calculating, and absolutely purposeful in everything she's doing. That's how I see her.
Yeah, you have a really different read on her than I do. So while they're going down to the moon, this is before the storm, this is before Yannick is monitoring those communications, and he and Vicar sleep together. They're first going down to LV-223. David delivers another quote from Lawrence of Arabia on the way down. He's obviously obsessed with this movie. He says, "There is nothing in the desert. No man needs nothing." Maybe you can offer some context here, but I looked this up, and it's a quote from a character called Faisal in that movie, and Faisal says,
"No Arab loves the desert. We love water and green trees. There's nothing in the desert. No man needs nothing."
So what does David mean here?
Contextually speaking of Lawrence of Arabia, there's a few wars being fought over deserts. And I think they might be talking about why the wars are happening. And the Arab doesn't agree because, like he says, you guys are fighting over something that no man needs. No man needs nothing. So no man need kill for nothing. I feel that's a similar thing to what David is talking about. I think that he thinks the only thing that they're fighting down there is the goo, and then that there's nothing else, and that they shouldn't keep going back down and endangering themselves for nothing.
So you think he might mean that he expects to find nothing? I was thinking that perhaps they're going to a place where he would be able to survive and thrive because he doesn't need the same things to do so that the human characters do. And also, he doesn't need answers in the way that the human characters do. And that's the impetus for going down there in the first place. But I thought that was an interesting quote. And they do call it out because one of the other characters notices that he says something. He basically says, oh, nothing. It's just a quote from a movie.
There is nothing in the desert. And no man needs nothing.
What was that?
Just something from a film I like.
So who among us has not been there?
Yeah.
The ship design, you want to talk about this a little bit? I thought it looked really good.
It's kind of an incredible thing. When we first see it flying through space, it's big and it's mean. But then we see them piloting it. And in the cockpit, it's kind of incredible. He just stands there in front of like a podium of controls, and he's got a peninsula of windows into this little turtle head cockpit that's attached to the body of Prometheus. And it was such a cool idea to be able to just like stand there and see almost entirely around you, which is something I've never seen. You always see people sitting. You always see one window. That's what was so fun about watching him pilot it, was giving him something that's probably fun to pilot.
Did you think the ship design was consistent with the designs in the rest of the series? I know you had some thoughts about the level of technology.
It's something that I refer to as the Phantom Menace problem, where in Star Wars The Phantom Menace, we have technology that is sleeker, clearly better designed than some of the boxy and rugged ships we have of A New Hope and The Empire Strikes Back. Everything about The Phantom Menace was new and sleek, and that's what I was kind of afraid of for Prometheus, because, and it kind of happens, but I think they tried hard. I mean, we can't really give people in 2012 black screen green text computers and like sticking a chip into something and being able to have like a Skype conversation, which was like the height of technology at that point. So there, you have to kind of sacrifice and give a modern audience modern technology. But I do think the design of the ship was stable with the other designs. It was boxy. It wasn't as sleek as it could have been. And it was very similar to the ship they have in Aliens.
I agree. I saw a major influence of those James Cameron designs.
That's how I felt too. And just the technology within the ship, like I said, of course, it can't be avoided. Unless, you know, Weyland is the head of all this new technology that's coming out. And after his death and Vickers' his death, and the company might actually lose a lot of this, because who knows? Prometheus might be a prototype of all these new things to come.
And the ship in the original, although it's much later, is a drilling ship.
Yeah, it's a mining vessel. And so, of course, they wouldn't need the amount of technology.
You don't want stuff that can crash. You want stuff that's old and reliable.
And you're right. You know, I never even actually considered the fact that you want things that we know that work. So why not fill a scummy mining ship up with the most basic tools? Prometheus, of course, of the legend, is the bringer of fire, stealing it from the gods to give it to man. And if we're trying to present ourselves to the engineers in the best way possible, I guess the Prometheus needs to be that fire.
I think we both like these designs. I think we both see a huge Cameron influence, but Cameron's technology designs, and this is, I think, true in all of the movies that he's done in the sci-fi genre, have a generic air about them. And Scott's designs do not. To use a metaphor from the 1980s, the decade that Aliens came out, and you know, James Cameron's designs are maybe Toshiba to Ridley Scott's Sony. Scott's stuff is sleeker. And sometimes this works to James Cameron's advantage as a director. You know, Terminator is a terrifying design, partly because it looks like something that somebody totally would design, right? It's nightmarish, but also inevitable. I mean, I remember seeing Terminator or seeing the pulse rifles in Aliens, and the reaction is like, oh yeah, that's the future. Definitely. That's definitely the future. And these Ridley Scott designs, you know, as they're going down to the planet, they're putting on these like World War II leather flight hats and these giant fishbowl helmets, which was a really cool thing.
Yeah.
It made them look fragile. They don't have just a glass piece in front and then like a helmet in the back. The whole thing is a glass bowl. That is not an inevitable design in the same way, right? That's like a cool design. I did like the look of this movie a lot. And I have to say, at this point, I start to be won over by this movie, and I haven't been fully with it, despite the Fassbender performance and the production design, because these characters are god-awful. So many of them.
Yeah, this is the point in the movie where the cloud comes over us. The second they enter this cave, they start talking about the atmosphere is different, how they can breathe in there. And someone goes off on that tangent about how they're terraforming. That's when things start to get a little cloudy, a little dark. As any watcher of film knows immediately, yes, this is bad. the second that guy was like, oh yeah, they're terraforming, I'm like, this is not a good place to be right now. And then of course there's the holograms of the running engineers, and then the head that's so big and beautiful it cost Ridley Scott half of his production budget. He had to request more money, and when they asked him why, he showed them the head and everybody got really pissed off about it. It's only in the movie for like 13 seconds, but totally worth it.
As with the Space Jockey set, which Fox didn't want to spend the money for in the first one, it adds something. I'm not sure that I would have spent a third of my budget or whatever you said on it, but
yeah.
Another production design note, I really like Fifield is, I'm not sure if he's Scottish, he's from the UK somewhere, but he's the geologist on this mission, and he's right. Got these little red scanner mapper droids that are like a supermarket scanner that's like shooting out laser lights in every direction to try and map out the caves. I thought those were a really cool design.
Yeah, I like those a lot.
And then we get some really portentous pieces here, like David playing with this holograph player, the engineer's body appearing where, like you said, there's this holographic recording. The recording shows him fall. They go there. There's a body there that's sort of ghostly. We have a good character moment that I really do like with Fifield at this moment.
Look, I'm just a geologist. I like rocks. I love rocks. Now, it's clear you two don't give a shit about rocks, but what you do seem to care about is gigantic dead bodies. And I don't really have anything to contribute in the gigantic dead body arena!
So I'm going to go back to the ship, if you don't mind.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes. Yes. He was almost our Bill Paxton. Like, everything that guy said was gold. And he was just that character that we needed at this point, because all we've had is either poorly characterized people. And then we have, like, Ice Queen, like Vickers, or the kind of dark curiosity that is constantly veiling David. And so it was nice to finally laugh while watching Prometheus, because that was kind of another thing about Alien and Aliens, is that there was always something to laugh about.
And so at this point, David opens the door. He's figured out how to use this technology somehow. And I think we buy that because he knows the language and maybe there's something he's figured out. He's very smart.
What are you doing, David?
I'm attempting to open the door.
Wait. We don't know what's on the other side.
Oops. Sorry.
And they find the head of this engineer that was decapitated by the door. It's in this elephantine helmet. The first time you watch this movie, do you recognize that suit as the space jockey yet?
I had only heard rumors that this was going to be a prequel to Alien. And then when I saw the space jockey armor, that's when I first got really, really excited that this was actually the movie that I was watching.
And, you know, even though there are some really dumb sci-fi tropes here, so like in addition to the cosmetically advanced prequel thing that you mentioned and this like magic breathable atmosphere, and the fact that everyone's like, oh, well, the atmosphere is okay, like, fuck microbes or whatever, it's going to be fine. So in spite of some of this really dumb stuff, the tension is just rising. And we get this room full of these metal canisters that are cylindrical, but also ovoid, I guess, round. And they look like metal versions of the alien egg.
And they're laid out exactly the same way. They're in perfect rows. It's almost like a military cemetery style of organization. The second you walk in and you see the cylinders, if you had seen Alien, that's the first thing you think of. And the first thing you should be thinking is, oh, fuck. Like, nothing good has ever come out of these things.
And something is coming out of them. There is something bubbling up off the top, but it doesn't look like condensation to me. I'm not entirely clear what's going on. I actually found the visual effect kind of confusing here.
I got the same feeling from these as I got from the eggs, that these things are capable of lying dormant for as long as necessary. And the same thing with the eggs, because we had no idea how long the eggs have been there before Ripley and crew stumble upon them. And it isn't until Ripley and crew stumble upon them that they even start to stir. And I felt the same thing about these tanks, that they could have been lying there for however long they were there. I think they say 2,000 years. And then the second that Shaw and crew come within breathing distance is when the things start to stir.
I completely agree that it's their presence that is causing something to change. It's just not clear to me what exactly is happening at this point. There are these elaborate murals on the walls. I think I see bits and pieces of the xenomorph, or at least some very Giger-esque designs. And then those start to change or become moldy very quickly. And Elizabeth Shaw speculates that something is changing the atmosphere. And then we get black ooze starting to seep out of the canister.
Beautiful painting.
It's a mural. Stop, don't touch it.
Sorry.
Please don't touch anything. The murals are changing. I think we've affected the atmosphere in the room. Charlie! David! We must leave now!
Do you want to talk now about some of the Scott stuff that you found with regard to the engineers and who the engineers were and the Christian stuff?
I was reading about this movie, preparing myself for this talk, and I stumbled upon an interview with Ridley Scott where he was kind of talking about what the engineers are and what he wanted them to be and what it meant for them to have created the human race. And someone asked him essentially the same question we're going to be asking ourselves in a little bit, is what did we do to earn the engineers' distaste, to have them design this biological weapon, which is something I feel we should talk about as well, to bring it back to Earth to essentially destroy our entire species. And David talks about it, you know, how like everybody wants to kill their father. The engineers might have been nervous that we were getting too powerful. But Ridley Scott, he brings up a point that 2,000 years ago, right around the time that this base was being built, one of the engineers went back to Earth to try and quell or like quench the anger that was on Earth, get us to stop being so violent, to get us to stop being so angry, to get us to stop destroying the gift that the engineers gave us, and that the engineer who went with this message was crucified and was the Christ figure that we know now. And that was the reason this base was built, the reason that this goo started to be stockpiled into these ships ready for deployment. And if you look at the statues and the carvings on the wall in the container room, we have the xenomorph that you were talking about, but it looks as though he's got his arms spread and his legs pulled down in a similar fashion of crucifixion.
I didn't catch that part at all. Is Scott clearly saying then that the engineer that goes and gets crucified, is that Jesus? Because
that's what I felt he was saying, and I feel that that's playing on the character of Shaw and her continued beliefs and like not wanting to stop figuring out what these engineers are all about. What Scott's suggesting is that this engineer was actually Jesus Christ, and our entire religious belief is based, again, not only on that the engineers have created us, but that they created almost everything that we live for, because we had this man who just showed up, was crucified for his beliefs and the things he was preaching. I think he wanted us to start thinking of Christ as one of the engineers who was coming down with a warning rather than a guidance.
Why call the movie Prometheus then? Why draw a name from a totally different religious tradition?
In the Roman times, or the legend of Prometheus, we could be having engineers on Earth, and Prometheus could be a real man who stole a gift from the engineers. We could have an engineer representing everything that we know about God or gods.
Or it could be an engineer who steals something from his own people and brings it to us.
Yeah, we could have a rogue engineer, absolutely, who's bringing something for us, like the secrets to temple building or pyramid building or the secrets to irrigation.
Oh, are you going back to Alien versus Predator now when you talk about this? They taught us how to build pyramids in that movie.
No, I'm talking mostly about the ancient aliens, how they believe that like irrigation and temple building was alien technology.
Yeah, that is a thread that runs through earlier movies in the series. Like I said, that's definitely there in Alien versus Predator. I guess I would prefer to forget that. I would prefer not to think that Ridley Scott is trying to tell us that Jesus was an engineer, because that just seems really corny to me and a little bit...
I think it's kind of a beautiful thing. Everything that mankind thinks they know rocked back on this one awful mistake that we made when the engineers gave us this chance, when he came down and told us the things, essentially the same thing that Jesus was telling us in the Bible. And then we said, you know, fuck you. You can't tell us what to do. You're not our dad anymore. Like Scott was talking about this too. I can't remember the exact quote, but he was saying the terrifying thing about the black goo was of how little it takes to do something. He said that there's reservoirs in England that you could corrupt the entire country with a teaspoon of bacteria, and he said this was the most terrifying thing about this film, was how easy it is to destroy something. And I think the most terrifying thing was how easily we could have fixed something. If we hadn't acted the way we did when like the engineer came to warn us of our actions, then where would we be? And I think like what's so frightening is how close we were to being completely decimated. We were on the brink of destruction if one of the engineers hadn't slipped up somehow the way that they did and destroyed their own little military base.
I guess I just like the, if you're going to go with an intelligent creator as your mythology, I like a watchmaker better. I like the idea that they just didn't care about us that much. Something more in line with the conversation that Charlie and David have, where David asks Charlie,
why do you think your people made me?
We made you because we could.
Can you imagine how disappointing it would be for you to hear the same thing from your creator?
I just like the idea that that is the answer from the engineers as well. I don't know. I guess there are just multiple readings of this. And a lot of what you're saying is to go back to the question of authorial intent. It's not in the movie, right?
No. The closest we come, of course, is the sacrificial creation story. We have what I believe to be a Christ-like carving of the creature on the wall. And then an ever-hanging question when they realize what was going on as to why. So like with your theory that like why make us because we could, then why work so hard to find something so potent to destroy us? Is it the same thing because they could?
Yeah, I don't know that we ever get an answer to that. I don't know that Scott has clear answers to this. And he's not the only author of this. You know, you mentioned Damon Lindelof. Damon Lindelof, not someone who I would put a lot of stock in having answers when he raises questions in a script, frankly. His pedigree is lost. And that's a show that has the reputation of raising questions and changing things around very frequently from week to week in order to keep people in the dark. You know, there may not be clear answers to these questions. I guess the mark of success for me for a movie like this is, are the questions evocative? And I'd prefer not to get too many answers, even though this is a movie that I suppose ostensibly is answering questions that were raised by the earlier films in the series.
But it's like you said, Lindelof is so notorious for giving you one thing and then taking away another. By answering the questions we have from the earlier films, we also get new questions based on this film. It's almost like we're breaking even constantly with the franchise. Because another question that comes up is that like the ship in Alien might not even be the ship in Prometheus, because it is a different moon. And so it could very well play into your theory that the engineers had done this multiple times, and that they might have been sending another transport into another society to destroy.
Although it seems like he crashed in that one, whereas in this, the ships are buried beneath these pyramids, and there's this sort of architectural structures on the planet, and that's something that he intended to do in the first movie, but just didn't have the budget to do, was build pyramid structures. So we only have a ship in the original Alien, and because the only space jockey we see in that is dead, I guess I have always read that as that ship crashed there, whereas this is clearly an installation.
Yeah, the only ship that leaves has Shaw on it and not the jockey.
Right. So the last shot we see inside the pyramid is of these worms, indigenous worms apparently, on this moon crawling into the black ooze that's been spilling out of the canisters. And as the away team is leaving, they're climbing into their space dune buggies. We see, they don't appear to see, a huge carving of what looks like an elongated skull towering over this cliff wall behind them. So did you read that? Is that a carving of the xenomorph, or is that just, you know, another engineer head that's been worn down by these millennia of silica storms that plague this planet?
That's a tough question. Were the xenomorphs that we know from Alien and Aliens created at the end of this, or do we think that the engineers already know that these creatures are capable of being made and have done it before and thus have their carvings? Because, I mean, they have to respect the xenomorphs because of how powerful and how devastatingly lethal they are, which is what they might have intended for the goo. And there has to be different species of them, because when we got Squid Face that bred with the engineer at the end, we got the one we were familiar with. But if they had intended to give the goo to us to make other ones to kill the rest of us, then they must know that these exist. But I'm having a hard time deciding whether the xenomorph was first created in this film or if it's happened before, and it's just something I can't lock my head around.
Yeah, it plays for me as though it's first created in this film, but then you have the carvings and the mural that seem to show it. So, I agree, it's unclear. So we have this silica storm, and then we're back on the ship. Fifield and Milburn are still in the pyramid, but the rest of our heroes return to the ship with a 2,000-year-old severed head, which they plug into an electrical outlet.
Right, essentially.
And it starts wriggling its eyebrows and silently screaming, and then it blows up and Nickelodeon gack flies everywhere. This is just another one of those moments where I'm just slapping my head and saying, what is going on? These people are not scientists. And also, this makes no sense, even if they aren't. So, like, Shaw somehow knows, she's an archaeologist, keep in mind.
Right.
She somehow knows that the lesions that appear on this ancient dead head are, quote, new cells, and that something is changing the head. This is a creature that died 2,000 years ago. She's never seen one before. No one's ever seen one before. This is stupid. Although I do like David's line here.
Mortal after all.
And then again, we get a perfect scene to bring it right back with David's essential assassination of Charlie, we start to see like the true nature of David. It's like you were talking about earlier, how he doesn't want answers. He just wants to see what will happen when things happen the way that they do. So he takes the black goo out. He puts a little bit on his finger, which is a great scene because we see in his fingerprints that he's got patterns instead of ridges.
He has a logo.
Which I just thought was such a great thing that you could almost miss because of how little of the time that finger spends on screen. But he puts a little dot on. What does he like whisper to himself? Great things have small beginnings.
Yeah. Is that another line from...
Oh, I don't know. I never thought about the Lawrence of Arabia bit here. I just thought...
Storm in a teacup, Dryden, a sideshow. If you want my own opinion, this whole theater of operations is a sideshow. The real war is being fought against the Germans, not the Turks. And not here, but on the Western Front, in the trenches. Your Bedouin army, or whatever it calls itself, would be a sideshow of a sideshow.
Big things have small beginnings, sir.
Does the Arab Bureau want a big thing in Arabia? If they rise against the Turks, does the Bureau think they're going to sit down quietly under us when this war is over?
The Bureau thinks the job of the moment, sir, is to win the war.
Every time I watch a movie, I really love to find the one line that I feel describes the entire thing. Because in almost every single movie, there's one line that kind of dictates the action and what's going to happen in the movie. And so this was it right here, where he says,
"Big things have small beginnings."
He does that super sneaky finger flick into the glass of whatever alcohol they're drinking and gives it to Charlie and just kind of sits back and is like, I can't wait to see what's going to happen here.
Yeah. And this is a very gray moment.
Right. Because like, he says, what would you do to find out about this stuff? Anything? He's like, good enough.
First of all, it's not clear that he knows that it's going to kill him, although I think he's clearly aware that it's a possibility. But he also is asking for consent in a way.
I think his programming makes him ask for it.
Oh, it's sort of Asimovian. Does he have like the three laws of robotics?
Exactly. Like he really wants to do it, but like there's something in him that won't let it happen until at least he gets the even like the foggiest of consent.
And there's a moment before this that I really love as well, where it's before he gets the canister of black ooze out of the freezer. He asks Vickers if she wants a cup of tea. And he's not threatening her. She doesn't have any idea what he's planning, and I don't think he intends that he's going to put the ooze in her drink instead. But I just thought that was sort of darkly humorous immediately before he does the same thing to Charlie. Going back to the head, is there a meaning to the sort of recurring motif of heads in this movie? There's that massive statue, there's that cliff face carving. Then we have the bit where it's the exploding head in the ship. In the end, we have another decapitation, the decapitation of David by the engineer, which prefigures what happens in the first movie with Ian Holmes' character of Ash.
Oh yeah, and then there's the engineer who is decapitated by the door during the race to the safety.
Which is the head that they bring back to the ship.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. If there is, I'm not seeing it. The giant head, the engineer head, I can't imagine anything but a worship thing.
Self-glorification, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, they are so, so fucking into themselves.
Now, if you were 8 feet tall and had, like, 36 abs, maybe you'd build a giant statue of your own head as well. Who knows?
I probably would. After that is when everything starts to happen. Then we have Charlie go back and he has sex with Shaw. And then Mohawk and Big Hood find the snake. And this is like our first real violent scene. Like earlier we had them dealing with the storm and we saw the hologram of the engineer being decapitated. And we had the engineer dissolving into the water in the beginning. But what was so good about the original Alien movies was how fantastically violent they were and how frighteningly real the violence was. And that's what happens with these guys in the temple when the snake comes. That scene when it spits the acid on his mask and it just sucks into his face, I just thought was one of the gnarliest things I had ever seen.
Does it spit acid? That's not how I remembered it. I guess I remembered it as though it got into the arm of his suit and then worked its way up into his helmet from there and then just immediately down his throat.
That was the second guy, Scottish Mohawk. He gets the blast in the face, which melts his helmet and breaks it, and then he falls face first into the goo, which was what infects him. And then the other one gets into his suit. First, it breaks his arm, which is a horrible scene, and then it spits at the other guy when he tries to pull it off, and then it gets into the suit and into the mouth.
And I take these snakes to be the worms that crawled into the goo in that last shot in the pyramid.
Yes, and like once they got into the goo, and then they got bigger and I guess more powerful.
And malicious. The goo does something to make you want to hurt people, I guess.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the case with Fifield as well. I do not understand mutant Fifield returning to the ship. You talked about the fact that you think the black goo just makes things aggressive. Is that what's going on here?
If you talk about all the theories people have about like why zombies are the way they are, I think the one that sticks closest to home is a violent need to spread. We have him returning to the ship, obviously under the control of whatever the black goo is. It was either designed or known to be a biological weapon. So if one person gets it, it creates a host that will work as hard as it can to make it so that everybody is either dead or has it as well. I think that's what the engineers were planning on doing with it by dropping it on Earth.
That's a lot more than I got out of it. I guess I just didn't understand what had happened to the character. And so I just thought Ridley Scott was like, oh, we need some action here.
No, I think it turns them into vessels, and I think that's how it works, is essentially the zombification.
Yeah, that scene there, especially with Milburn, the guy who gets the snake just sort of chokes him to death. It goes down his throat, and it was a pretty clear reference in my mind to the facehugger in the first movie, which Dan O'Bannon, again, the co-writer of the original Alien, identified a lot of the horror in that movie as coming from the facehugger, which was a metaphor for, in his words, homosexual oral rape. And that's pretty clearly what's going on in this scene, too. I mean, those snakes are as phallic as you can possibly be, even though when they fan out, they look pretty vaginal, too. And that's just Giger for you. Putting genitals together and making them want to kill you, that's H.R. Giger in a nutshell.
I think the most frightening thing about the facehuggers was that there's a violent attachment, obviously a violent impregnation that you don't know is happening to you, but then it just dies, and then you're alive. Like, you just spent, like, the last 3 nights comatose with this thing sleeping in your body, like, on your face, and then you wake up and you have no idea what it was doing to you, or why it just died and left you alive. When Zombie Charlie impregnates Shaw with the squid that looks so alarmingly like the facehugger, that's when I started thinking, oh no, like, it's happening again, and it's gigantic.
Can we run through some of the characters?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so Fifield, Scottish Mohawk guy.
Scottish Mohawk, head tattoos, designs a part of the helmet to have nicotine in it.
I read that as pot. I thought he was smoking pot.
Oh, I just heard them talking about tobacco, so I just assumed it was just regular tobacco.
I thought Milburn was asking, is that tobacco? And he was like, yeah, it's tobacco.
Okay, yeah, that subtlety slipped by me. So yes, that makes... Okay, but still, designs a helmet that he can smoke pot in, has the head tattoos, has the red mohawk, but for some reason loves rocks. Like, I always think it's so charming when guys who are this wild and out there are so into something so stable.
No, I agree. He's a fun character. I mean, the smoking pot in his helmet and then getting immediately killed was like a little bit out of Friday the 13th, but...
Absolutely, absolutely.
And he also has the line, I think that he literally has the line right after he gets out of stasis. He's like, I'm not here to make friends.
Yeah, it's a... he woke up on the real world.
But he is fun. The guy who he's with when he gets killed, the guy's name, I keep using his name, Milburn. I don't think I got that from the movie. I don't know.
Yeah, I keep calling him Big Hood because in the beginning he was wearing that ugly sweatshirt that had like the full head hood.
Just like the snake that ends up killing him.
There you go. Look at that.
Boy, that guy has like no personality whatsoever. He's like this really obnoxious southern accent.
And those stupid, stupid translucent glasses with the pointed frames.
I'm going to read you a list of characters who are in this movie, and you can tell me if you have any idea who they are, because they do have names on IMDb, but I think this movie does.
Except for Mercenary 3 and 4, right?
Tell me if you have any idea who these people are. Chance. Ray. Wallace.
Ray.
Ravel. Barnes.
I know Ravel was Yannick's first mate, right? Yeah, I think Chance and Ravel were the two that also make the decision to crash the Prometheus into the escaping alien ship.
I think you're right. The Scottish scientist, she has a name. Her name is Ford.
Okay.
And then there are the mercenaries. The mercenaries' names are Taplow, Jackson, Shepherd, and of course, Ladimir, because you cannot have a group of mercenaries without having like a guy who used to be KGB, even though
exactly. That
would have fallen like 112 years ago or whatever.
Yeah, so mostly it ends after Ravel and Ford of characters to care about.
And boy, they don't get a whole hell of a lot of characterization either.
No.
You know, I like them. They're pleasant enough. Everybody's got a different accent, but they have characteristics. They're not really characters.
Absolutely, yeah.
So they're trying to get back into the ship, and Holloway is getting sick, and Vickers, I love Vickers for asking, sick with what?
Is anyone there? This is Vickers. I need a medical team standing by the airlock. All quarantine failsafe. He's sick.
Sick with what?
Just did it.
I'm suiting up. Think your status in order. Get that damn door open. What the hell is this?
He's not coming on board.
Vickers, this is a sick man.
I can see that. That's why he's not coming on my ship.
She's not willing to let him back onto the ship. I just think that she is the Ripley of this movie. She's the one who wants to do the things that make sense. She's asking the hard questions. She's following regulations and quarantine in the way that Ripley did in the first movie. I don't know if you remember, Ripley's the one who wasn't going to let him back on, and it's Ian Holm who overrides that.
See, I think at the same time, Vickers has got Ripley and Ian Holmes going on. She wants to see what's happening, what was left of the engineers that could help Waylon, but at the same time doing what she needs to do to save face.
Isn't she the one who burns him up?
Yeah, but after she sees what it is. Because they're talking about him being sick in the pyramids, and she lets them get close enough to the ship to see what's wrong before, like, flaming him. Because, like, the whole time she's watching their journey into the pyramids, she's just standing there drinking tea, like, watching it. Like, she's doing it with David, and then she does it when they go back.
Okay, Charlie Holloway. I really don't like this character. He's extremely unlikable, and I sort of wonder whether this is on purpose so that you don't feel too bad about David when he is murdered by David.
Yeah, he's kind of just like the perpetual graduate student. He wears those scarves and has, I'm sure there's a scene where he has bracelets, and I'm pretty sure, like, I might just be imagining this, but I feel him like rocking capris everywhere he goes. And he's got that like perfectly manicured 5 o'clock shadow and head. He's just kind of just like that college douche that everybody hates because he thinks he knows so much more than you and is like willing to prove it no matter how much it takes. And then after, like, finding the head, when he just inclines himself to get drunk, I don't really understand what he's so upset about.
Okay, well, I think I can shed some light on that, because I did watch the deleted scenes. I also read an earlier version of the script. I'll talk about that in a little bit more depth later. But in the deleted scenes, douche is the right word for it. He is upset because he came here to talk to the engineers, not to do an autopsy on the head.
Oh, okay.
He wanted answers, and he didn't get his answers. That's what he's pissed about.
Oh, see, and then the douchey thing is he just spends the rest of the time getting drunk and, like, moping. Like, when David finds him to poison him, he's just knocking pool balls back around on the table.
Yep.
Like, it's just like, wah, shut up. Like, you got your grant, you got your fine. Just because you couldn't talk to him doesn't mean you didn't do something incredible. But that doesn't seem to mean anything to him.
And he's a jerk to Elizabeth Shaw as well.
Yeah.
Although I hate Elizabeth Shaw. I think that what I don't like about this character, aside from the fact that I don't identify with her faith motivations, there's one decision that's made in the script and her performance doesn't salvage it that I just drives me nuts, which is that she is essentially characterized by her femaleness. The thing that seems to be driving her, in addition to her faith, is the fact that she is barren. She cannot get pregnant. She can't create life. This is stuff that is sort of potentially thematically interesting, given the themes of the origins of life in this movie, but it just thuds. It is so badly executed in this movie. It's dull, convenient character motivation. And then after Charlie is burned to death, Elizabeth wakes up. She's told she's pregnant, and David is a real bastard here. He says,
"Well, Doctor, it's not exactly a traditional fetus."
I really love that foreign body extraction is the setting that she has to settle on. You know, Alien is a specific reference for a lot of female friends of mine who don't ever want to have babies. Something inside you feeding off of you that isn't you. So I thought that was a nice touch.
I agree with you. I think they made too big of a deal of the sterility. Everyone calls it a pregnancy. I don't really consider what happens to her being impregnated. I think the sterility is just to add a kind of horror to what happens to her, because I think she's just infested almost more like an STD than a pregnancy by poisoned sick Charlie through the exchange of bodily fluids. She gets infested with the squid. Even if she wasn't sterile, the whole invasion thing would have been terrifying. I think it was kind of like a pointless hark to a virgin pregnancy to give her that Mary moment.
I agree completely that I read it as sort of an infection, you know, and I really like that turn in the med pod there, because this character who is so devastated apparently by her inability to get pregnant ends up giving herself an abortion.
And a brutal one.
Yeah, although it actually ends up being a C-section just because it's growing so fast.
Yeah, and it's a rough scene because she has to convince the machine to do it for her, because it keeps asking her what's wrong and she can't figure out a way to really say it. It's like a race against time. Like, you can almost see it moving in her, and she's trying to get it out, and she's trying to find the best way to convince the machine to rip her open.
I don't know if you caught it, but part of the reason she's having trouble getting it to do what she wants is that the machine is calibrated only for a man, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, you know, technologically, but is a little clue to you. you that Waylon, who hasn't yet been revealed as being alive, is actually there.
Oh, okay.
That med pod's not for Vickers's use, it's for Waylon's.
You know, that completely slipped by me, and this is kind of an eye-opening moment.
I'm glad I can help. Although I really loathe the fact that she gets out of the thing and immediately starts like booking it. She's like, oh, I have staples in my belly. I guess I'll run as fast as I can now.
If you had just watched a squid get ripped from your body and you realized that this was happening to all the people around you, like, I think you would do it with some haste as well.
Yeah. Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty. And one thing I know, it is true, yeah.
And now finally we get the reveal that Peter Weyland is gasp alive and on the ship, and Vickers is father. But I really do like the fact that both she and David pretty baldly acknowledge that they just want him to die already.
Yeah.
Doesn't everyone want their parents dead?
A king has his reign, and then he dies. It's inevitable. That is a natural order of things.
And then we have this little second away team mission, including Wayland in his exoskeleton, wanting to ask for a little bit more life. And it doesn't go well.
No, it certainly does not. We have the conversation between David and the engineer, and what happens after that is blood. Blood and milk, I guess. We get David's head ripped off. Wayland gets killed. No, we have him trying to take off first. And then Shaw has this smart horror movie idea to go investigate the ship to see if anything's still alive. And that's when she finds an engineer who's dying and who sees her and gets all pissed off again and gets that dying strength to try and kill her. And we have Shaw on the run again and is chased into the vessel by the engineer, only to stumble upon what she thought was her dead fetus, which is now just gigantic, almost bigger than the engineer itself. She finds the fetus behind the door, but then takes on the engineer, and then what we get from that is the xenomorph that we all know and love.
Sort of. The head's a little bit differently shaped.
One person, I can't remember where this was, I was reading that the reason the head is shaped so differently is because that's what the queen looks like when it's young. And that the queen, eventually, when she grows up, has a very different head and a very different body than the drones. This is where our story essentially splits. This is what makes it such a loosely considered prequel, because we have the Shaw story going on, we have the xenomorph, and then we have Ripley's story 40 years in the future in a completely different part of the world. And all we have to connect us is that one xenomorph.
There's so much fungibility with what the black goo does and with the pace and order of evolution, if you want to call it evolution. I think it's pretty clear that that is a xenomorph, whether it's the specific one we've seen before. And in Alien 3, we also get a clear indication that the alien looks and behaves differently when it comes out of different creatures.
I personally like the theory of the queen, because we need something to lay the eggs that Ripley stumbles upon. The theory I'm going with is that the thing that comes out of the engineer is the queen.
I just want to clearly lay out the sequence of events here. The engineer wakes up, he rips David's head off, he kills everyone else who's present in this little away party, doesn't give Wayland the more life he wants. This is the point where Wayland says, "There's nothing, is there?" And David says to him, "I know," which is a nice moment. And then he tries to take off, apparently wanting to finish his mission and go to Earth and kill everyone.
Oh, that's right, because they find the computer that had the coordinates for Earth.
You have to stop it!
We're not stopping anything, Shaw. We're going home.
Yannick, if you don't stop it, it won't be a home to go back to.
and they play the flute to get things to work. Close Encounters is my understanding, although I still haven't seen that movie. I
can't believe you haven't fucking seen that.
Yannick has previously speculated that this is a weapons installation based on apparently limited evidence, but that's what he thinks, and it seems that now he may be correct. And he crashes the Prometheus, along with his navigator and his first mate, into the horseshoe-shaped spaceship that we recognize from the original Alien, which looks just as incredible in motion as it did sitting there dead as part of the landscape in the original Alien. And the horseshoe-shaped ship starts rolling along like a hula hoop on the ground and crushes Vickers. I really wish it had crushed Shaw. Vickers was a much more interesting character for me. And then we get Engineer versus grown-up Squid Baby, which looks, like you said, a lot like a very, very large face hugger, although it has multiple mouths with these sort of flower petal vagina dentata beak things.
And it's kind of interesting to think about how the face huggers start off so large but end up becoming so small. Again, I feel like that goes back to what we were talking about, how that might not be the xenomorph that we all know, but it could very well easily be the beginning of it. And then this is how fast the black goo gets things to evolve and adapt.
More than the pace of the evolution, the biggest difference to my mind is that the original Alien shows you a life cycle, right? It shows you a complete life cycle of the thing, and it seems to be able to self-replicate. And in this, there's no need for there to be a life cycle because it can just sort of magic a creature into another creature as necessary, right?
Right.
There's not like a natural circle from birth to reproduction to death in the same way. Yeah, so the giant face hugger released by Elizabeth from captivity fights the Engineer. Not clear if it does that because it recognizes it or because it's imprinted on Elizabeth. It's really not clear. I saw it as possibly defending its mommy, but she runs off before we have a chance to see whether it would have killed her too. She grabs David's head. Does she go to the Prometheus lifeboat?
No, she takes one of the multiple Engineer ships because David knows how to pilot it. And that's where she finds the coordinates for the Engineer planet. And that's what she sets off for.
And records a last captain's log a la Ripley in the original Alien, although hers is rather tedious and all about Jesus.
Yeah. And then it's done.
Is this a horror movie?
No, absolutely not. In the way that Alien is, no, it's absolutely not. It's more along the lines of Aliens than anything. I have this conversation with friends where I ask them what their favorite sci-fi movie is, and they tell me, and I have to, of course, argue that the movie they list is not sci-fi. The whole thing about sci-fi is that it has to be a movie based on a fear of technology and what that will do to us, and so I have a hard time even calling this one sci-fi because it's not essentially the technology that we're so afraid of. It's actually what started us, which wasn't even technology. I was reading something that someone wrote about the Black goo and how they thought that if the xenomorphs already existed, that the engineers were harvesting the black goo from them and using it to break down. So even that's not technology as much as it is an organic substance.
The whole point about several of the earlier movies is that people are saying, well, we can weaponize these things, but you can't because they are too chaotic, uncontrollable, powerful.
I think chaotic is like not the most inappropriate word, but although they do create chaos, they're just like a perfectly designed, perfectly instinctual killing machine. I don't think there's anything chaotic about what the xenomorphs do other than chaos that they make around them.
I see what you mean.
So like I said, I even have a hard time calling this movie sci-fi, but I would definitely not say that it's horror. There is nothing all that terrifyingly unknown about Prometheus. And in many ways, it's kind of the same action movie as Aliens, just with a lot less guns and a lot less aliens.
It's also a philosophy movie. This movie is a lot more about philosophical exposition, more concerned with asking questions than with showing you something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't think it's a surprise at this point for me to say that I think this is a much, much weaker film than the original Alien. And part of that I put to the fact that it's so much more talky, and so the emphasis on the thing that Scott does so well, atmosphere, is lessened in comparison.
To be fair, so few movies actually surpass the original Alien. I get the feeling from this that Scott wasn't trying to do that as much as kind of write the fans of the original one a love letter, like, here's the answer to all your questions, but if you don't mind, I'd like to start another franchise jumping off my first one. Here's the space jockey. Here's what he actually looks like. Here's what he was doing there. And this is where the aliens started. Now I need to work on my Prometheus thing. That's why I feel like you can only call it a prequel in the loosest sense, seeing as how it only has like three or four strings attaching it to the original Alien franchise.
I also think there are too many characters in this movie, and that the characters have this quality of being a team of experts on different things that sort of only ever exists in the movies. It's not a real type of group of people in the way that in the original Alien, you had this group of blue-collar workers who were on a crew together for a long time, seemed to have relationships. They were realistic and were an analog of something that exists in the real world, and so you could get away with sort of just sketching those relationships. But there's just no verisimilitude in Prometheus for the team because it doesn't exist in real life.
Yeah, I know. That is true. It's kind of bizarre to think about how this whole team was kind of just hired. None of them were part of a team ever once or twice before, except for maybe Chance and Ravel might have been on there with Yannick, might have piloted with him before. It's not even Yannick's ship. It's built, and then he was assigned to it. So, like, almost nothing holds its own ground here.
And none of them know what they're doing there. They're speculating. Right. Hence the bet about whether they're there to do terraforming or not.
Yeah, so, like, the whole thing is so piecemeal.
One of the things that you said about the Xenomorph is, what did you say? It's very efficient? Or what was the word you used?
Perfect.
It's perfect. Yeah. It's pure. Ash says that in the original Alien. He says, I admire its purity.
Yeah, it's a perfect killing machine, Ed. Even in its death, it's killing because it's developed the acid blood. So, like, even if you did take it on and were able to wound it, its wounds would still cause more wounds.
It is the ultimate survivor.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a perfect drifter.
It can live in the vacuum. There's something essential about the Xenomorph. It's a mysterious creature at the start as we watch the first Alien. That becomes less true as the movies progress, and I think that's a weakness. We end up knowing too much about it, maybe. But as we get answers about the Xenomorph, those answers reveal, like I said, reveal a complete life cycle, right? And so if the Xenomorph is evil, if it seems evil to us, it's evil because it is a natural creature and nature is amoral.
It's the same thing as, like, when a person gets bit by a shark and they decide that they need to kill the shark because it's an evil thing. As much as we can be terrified of sharks, we can't be mad, because it's not like the Xenomorph is choosing to do this. It's built and designed to do this. It's an animal. It's not a rational, self-aware creature.
Have you fucking seen Jaws?
Yes, I've seen Jaws.
You know, the creatures that are in this movie, they don't have life cycles. The black ooze removes the need for that jigsaw puzzle that actually fits together, right?
Well, it only starts off as not having a life cycle. We get poisoned Charlie, but then Charlie starts the life cycle by passing it on in a way that could create life. So then we have Elizabeth carrying it, and then we have it being born, it living, and it impregnating again.
You see what's happening to Charlie as being the same thing, but a slower process as what happens to Fifield.
I think the black coup could even be so powerful that the amount given could do different things. What happens to Fifield is he falls face first into the goo. Like, he gets a mouthful, he gets eyes full, like a nose full. It's on his pores, it's in his skin. Charlie only gets the drop that he ingests. So it's probably more rapid and violent with Fifield, but that doesn't mean to say that it isn't the same thing happening to them, just Charlie's experiencing it much more slowly.
Well, I think it's kind of noble in that case. If it's the same thing that's happening, I like the fact that he wants to die. He's still got his mind at that point, and he knows that something bad is coming. So that's a redemptive moment in that case for me, for Charlie Holloway. Where would you rate this in the series?
For me, it changes between Alien and Aliens. Every time I listen to Bill Paxton, like, I always remind myself, I always tell myself that Aliens is my favorite one. But I think I will always say that it's Alien, Aliens, Prometheus, Alien 3, and then the rest of them.
Would you put Alien 4 above the Alien versus Predator ones?
Unfortunately, yes, because even though they did do Alien versus Predator 2, which was rated R, but I haven't seen either of them, so I can't really give you an honest answer.
Well, I can believe that you haven't seen those, so I wouldn't worry about it too much. Yeah, I think I would put them in the same order, although with the caveat that it's been a while since I've seen Alien 3, and my opinion may change next time I see it. Alien is always closer to my heart, although less rewatchable than Aliens.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, Aliens you can watch late at night and not fall asleep to, but Alien has the same kind of thing that 2001 has, is that if you're attentive and well-rested and probably not as well fed as you should be, then you can sit through and, like, really focus on it. But otherwise, if you're in any other weakened state, it could lull you.
For all its flaws, and I think there are a lot of flaws in this movie, this is a movie made by someone who cares about what he's trying to say here. And he is trying to say something, even though it comes through sort of muddled. He's asking questions. This is an older man. He's in his 70s now. He made this movie before his brother died, but his brother, who I think was younger than him, Tony Scott, just killed himself fairly recently because he had brain cancer. And I think the questions that are reflected in this movie about mortality are earnestly meant.
I think for all of its flaws, Prometheus floored me. I really liked the ideas that they were bringing up. It was fun and really kind of like, it's like you said, a movie can be judged based on the fact of its questions. The questions it asks are evoking something. And I think that absolutely happened. Like when I saw it, I had friends who had never seen Alien. I was like, well, you got to see it. Like, we'll go see Prometheus again and then we'll go see Alien. And then we went and talked about it for a while. And I think just us being able to do this thing that we're doing right now is a sign of how good that Prometheus was despite itself. The end justifies what it took to get there. And it's better than the sum of its parts.
I agree. So before we wrap up, can I give you some info on the much earlier version of the script that I read, which was written by a guy named David Spaeth?
Yeah, let's do it.
The version of the script I read was for a movie called Alien: Engineers. There was a lot of bad dialogue in that version of the script. Some excerpts here. We have the following exchange between Shaw and Holloway. Shaw's name is Watts in that one, and Peter Weyland. They go to visit Peter Weyland to ask for funding, and Weyland indicates that he knows what they're working on. Holloway says, "That's impossible. Our research is..." And then Weyland replies, "Quantum encoded and on secure servers. Yeah, we have an AI division, you should know, doing impressive things. I know which star you're wishing on."
Ugh. Fuck. That's disgusting.
Weyland plays a much bigger role in this version of the movie. He's alive from the start. Everybody knows it. He has a really expository God complex. He talks about how he's God pretty explicitly, which is never a good sign. Nobody is going to survive a movie who says that. Holloway is an older character, and Shaw, again, whose name is Watts, and this one is his former student. I don't remember whether they're involved. I don't think they're involved romantically. I don't remember. Star maps from the cave paintings in Prometheus might seem bad to us, but it is not as bad as the original idea, which also included unexplained pulses, which were booster shots to the human genome that took place every 1,100 years.
Ew. Like, I'm so glad he chose Damon Lindelof to come in then, because I can't imagine what it would feel like to be like a screenwriter and be given a script and be like, "Hey, I need you to do rewrites on this," and to look at it and be like, "Oh, you mean you want me to write the movie again?"
Yeah. The ship in the original version that I read was called the Magellan. So the fact that they, you know, that connotates exploration definitely. Right. But the fact that they changed the name of the ship to the Prometheus and changed the title of the movie to the Prometheus,
right,
really changes the frame through which we're meant to view the film, right? It pulls it away from the Alien franchise, and it pulls it toward that idea of gifts from the gods.
And yeah, the Magellan would not have evoked as many of the things that we're talking about as it does with Prometheus. Magellan is almost kind of just tacky. You couldn't have thought of something better. Like even Magellan is like not even that great of an explorer.
The Amerigo Vespucci. Well, I guess he just drew a map. David, the character of David, believed in the research from the start. He wasn't skeptical of it in the way that he is in the final film, and there was no antagonism between him and Holloway, at least at the start. A lot of the set pieces in the movie were the same. So we had Fifield and Milburn getting attacked and Fifield mutating. We had Shaw running away from the ship as it crashes, the engineer waking up and tearing off David's head, the med pod, the ships crashing into each other. Most of them were in the same order. Most of them occurred for the same reasons. The broad strokes of the thing were similar. Some of the major differences, David was way more overtly villainous, and Vickers was too, and the relationship between those two were different. So Vickers was clearly David's master, whereas they play more like sibling rivals in the final movie.
Okay.
Vickers wanted profits. She wanted to start sawing technology out of the pyramid, like, as soon as they got there. And so he was ordered to help Shaw and Holloway until they found the technology, and then to shut them up. And he goes rampant. He goes nuts, basically, when he has to learn the, quote, trinary language used to run the engineers' computers. I found this to be aggressively stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a perfect term for what that is.
So David kind of Paul Reiser's Shaw. He puts an alien in her on purpose using a traditional facehugger that they find. Whereas in the final movie, he has a rapport with her. She laughs when he makes fun of Charlie early on. He shows apparent concern after she nearly dies going back into the storm to recover the head. She doesn't fully trust him, I think, in the final movie, but there's a detente that happens at the end. Anyway,
I am convinced that Shaw was the only one David liked, as much as he can like anybody.
In the original script, Holloway doesn't impregnate Shaw. He gets his chest burst by an alien like the one at the end of the finished film that's not quite an alien. Shaw gets the alien out of herself with the med pod, just like in this movie, but then she shoots it.
Oh.
And it dies. Which actually would have been kind of fun, but, you know, I like the way that it plays in the final film a little bit better. There are a lot more characters. There's a lot more dialogue. It would have made for a faster-paced movie, even though there was more dialogue, because there was a lot less attention paid to the atmosphere, I think, than Scott pays. Tonally, it really, that script feels a lot more like a sequel to Alien Resurrection than this movie does, and I am very grateful that that is not the case in the final film, because I really don't like Alien Resurrection.
No, me. Yeah.
There are a lot more types of creatures in Prometheus than there are in the previous versions of the movies, with the exception of the apocryphal and totally never happened Alien versus Predator movies. But in the screenplay, these creatures seem overly complicated and don't fit in with the Alien series. They seem like that stupid white alien-human hybrid creature in Alien Resurrection, you know?
Oh, God, that thing.
Over-described, too much detail. And then perhaps the worst thing about the original script is that instead of there being a mysterious black goo, the canisters contain DNA scarabs. Scarabs like beetles. So,
like in The Mummy?
Yes, it reads exactly like The Mummy. Yeah, exactly. They're like crawl under the skin and get you.
Oh, man, that would be gold.
Overall, Prometheus is better.
Yes.
But the script is not without a couple of nice touches, and in particular, I like the ending of the script better than the ending of the finished movie. So in this version, Shaw is stuck in a very small life support pod after the ship crashes and she, you know, escapes. And David's head, torn off, is still inside the pyramid, and they're communicating by radio. So David, who has, again, put an alien inside of her already, he's already tried to kill her, or at least not cared if she died. David is trying to convince her that she should come and repair him so that he can fly them off the planet. But she's really not having any of it because he put a fucking alien inside her.
Right, right. So
she's convinced that another ship is going to come, but he says that it might not be a human ship that comes. And so they keep talking around it and they start playing a chess game together over the radio, implying that they've been at this impasse for a while. And it's not clear how they're going to resolve it. And the movie ends on that note. I like that sort of lack of trust, but maybe having to find a way to work together relationship. I like that ending better than the final ending in the movie.
Yeah, it leaves a lot less open for a sequel, though, because they're already writing Prometheus 2.
Is Lindelof writing it or someone else?
I think Lindelof dropped out of it. I don't know for sure, because most of what everything that's going on is rumors and speculation and just a little bit of validation here and there.
And is Scott signed on as director in theory?
I believe so, because he says he's not done with it.
He's so old. I guess it made pretty good money. It made
$403 million, right? Which is not bad for a movie that costs $180.
Wow, did it cost that much? I read the production budget as $130, but I guess that doesn't include advertising.
Yeah, advertising, and then that was pretty expensive, also because he shot the entire thing with 3D cameras. So that was a bit more costly than regular digital.
Hey, so how are we going to rate movies? Are we going to, like, do straight thumbs up, thumbs down? Are we going to give it a letter grade? What do you want to do?
We can do letter grades. That's pretty easy, and we don't have to deal with, like, 7.9s or anything like that.
I would give Prometheus a B minus. This is a B minus picture for me.
I'm going to straight up say that, like, it's a solid B plus. If it had been half an hour longer and had dropped a few of its flaws, it could be a solid A. But it was too compact and just a little too dry.
You know what? We're going to triangulate on this motherfucker. We're going to give a letter grade, but we're also going to say, and I recommend it. Because can you imagine a situation in which you'd be like, this movie is an F minus and I recommend that you watch it? Because I can definitely, there are movies that I would put in that category.
Oh yeah, I can think of a couple movies.
Yeah, so this is for me a B minus movie, and I don't mean that in the sense of a B picture.
Right, obviously.
But this is a B minus movie, and I definitely think it's worth watching.
Absolutely, absolutely. I recommend Prometheus to just about everybody I talk to about movies because it is powerful in its own way, and it is just a really great beginning to what became and then stopped being a great franchise.
We should probably mention, which we didn't at the start, that one of the ways we are envisioning this podcast is as a forum for us to talk about books, movies, or other works of art that one of us or anybody who joins us on the podcast in future episodes hasn't yet experienced.
So what are we thinking about doing next time?
Well, as much as I wanted to kind of split up the genres of things we were talking about, I didn't want to do two sci-fis in a row. You did mention earlier in our talk that you haven't fucking seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which in this man's humble opinion is the great sci-fi movie ever made. One of the only ones that was ever inducted into the Library of Congress for science. So I think you should grace yourself with the 3 hours that is Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Wait, how long is that movie?
It's about 3 hours.
Jesus Christ. Is, like, the theatrical cut of that movie was 3 hours?
Just about, yeah, I think.
We are going to try to keep a loose continuation from one episode to the next. So I guess in this case, the thread is aliens.
I don't know if we can call the engineers aliens because they are us. Like, our DNA is theirs and theirs is ours. But I guess if we talk about the xenomorphs, then we're talking about a wild animal alien. And the next branch could be talking about ones that are intelligent enough to not only visit, but to communicate. And yeah, that's all I'll say since you're going to watch it. But I think that's a good thread going from one edge of the spectrum to the complete opposite.
Outstanding. Well, all right, Alex. Thanks for joining me on this epic 3-hour conversation. We'll see how far this gets cut down. And I hope those of you listening have enjoyed it. Yeah, keep on fucking watching stuff.
And keep on fucking watching stuff. I'm down.
Our opening and closing music is performed by Star Patrol. All works of art that we cover on Boom Culture are the property of their respective copyright holders. Please don't sue us. So distance from Earth, it tells us we are about 3.5 light years from Earth. So by comparison, the planet Pluto, which, you know, that shit is a planet. It's a planet. Pluto is a planet.
Hey, NASA, your mom thought I was big enough, right?
Oh, that's good. I get your joke about phalluses. Pluto, between 4 and 7 light hours from Earth. You've got these like blown out yellows in the suits and in the stasis chambers that look like a sun lamp. Like, I feel like they should show this movie in Seattle and it would like cut the suicide rate in half. It's so bright.
And it can adapt to any creature it symbiotes with.
Yeah, it can. Well, if, I don't know whether it's a symbiotic or parasitic relationship.
Yeah, I was going to rebate that. I could take that back, but.